RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome. You are here with Marie on Reality Check Radio for a very special Media Matters. Marty and I, you may have caught on Wednesday on Counterculture, we discussed very briefly an article that was in the Sunday Star Times, How China Targeted Our Mayors, by Louisa Cleave and Paula Penfold. And it was the written article that followed up the new release of the Stuff Circuit, the Long Game documentary, which was interestingly timed for the visit of the Chinese premier. We both looked at this article. There was a lot there. The Stuff Circuit documentaries certainly garner a lot of comment from people on our side of the fence. So we decided that instead of just giving it a few moments in Media Matters, that we would give it a good old deep dive and cast our ideas a little bit further afield. And the one thing that stood out for me was, it's something that I heard was phrased by Neil Oliver the other day, which was, you feel like that you've walked in and they've started the story in the third act, meaning that there is a whole bunch of stuff that they missed. So good morning, Marty. Welcome along for our little chat. That's a big introduction. So yeah, you and I have taken the weekend to have a good look at this. We looked at the documentary, we looked at this influence. The first thing that struck me is I just kept thinking, well, look, I actually don't dispute anything that they had in the article or the documentary. I think they've probably done some solid work there, but I just felt like that they missed out so much.
Yeah, they never got around to saying Chinese Communist Party for a start.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of, I for one welcome our new insect overlords by our media people. Fran O'Sullivan in this weekend's paper has written something gushing. And
that was about the business delegation dinner. Is that the one or
yeah,
the meeting?
Yeah, on the Weekend Herald, Lee urges business leaders to play peacemakers. So he's wanting business leaders to get together with government. I feel that's been done before, isn't it? It's called fascism. It's a pincer movement. He's pointing at the trade and saying, don't mess it up. And that's a... it's a valid consideration, you know, and I guess I'd want to preface this discussion by saying that I admire a great deal about Chinese culture. I'm something of a Sinophile. I've studied the I Ching extensively. It's an incredible bit of thinking. The Chinese think about time in the same way as the West has been fascinated by matter. Many of the ways that the I Ching presents time are increasingly validated by theoretical physics and experimental physics. Confucianism, you know, which was, of course, forms the basis of 2,000 years of Chinese thinking. Fascinating. Very, very useful. We'll get back to that later. But Taoism, there's a lot to love. And, yeah, it's important to understand that the Chinese are playing a very long game while we're playing either this pathetic three-year term, let's see who can get the most trade game, with often compromised politicians, and the media are playing an even shorter game. So, you know, we're going up against I wouldn't say an adversary, because we're cooperative in a lot of ways, but we're playing with someone who's playing a long game and we're playing a short game, and we've catch up.
So the article, as I said, How China Targeted Our Mayors, Jiang Yikun's interest in befriending politicians went beyond large donations to National and Labour. He was also courting mayors in both ends of the country, cultivating relationships on behalf of officials in China. Stuff Circuit's Louisa Cleave, Paula Penfold look into the connections and who benefited from them. Much of the documentary and the article talk about the donation scandal that Jamie Lee Ross was at the heart at, and Simon Bridges to an extent. And they started making this documentary in early 2021. And then, of course, they had to put the brakes on it because this became a legal matter, so they couldn't continue further. And actually, Tony Longbottom, the director, came in and said to both of them, well, you're going to have to put a pause on this and find something else to
find another bogeyman.
Yeah, which of course then became Fire and Fury, and we're not going to, you know, talk about that cluster. Anywho, the opening to this article When called upon, they stepped up for Zhang Yikun. Phil Goff, a former Labour leader minister and Auckland mayor, who was about to become New Zealand's High Commissioner to the UK, proffered a character reference. So did ex-National MP Eric Roy, who with Goff co-signed Zhang's nomination for a royal honour. A former Southland mayor, Gary Tong, who went on two trips to China with the businessman. Artist and veteran activist Tama Iti. Oh, artist, is that what we're putting on the CV these days? Artist. On a trip with Tong, and the Māori Party president, John Tamahere, rounded out the high-profile supporters when Zhang was sentenced on a charge of obtaining by deception in relation to a $100,000 donation made to the National Party in 2018. They concentrate heavily on Gary Tong and Jamie Lee Ross and a little bit on Phil Goff. Absolutely zero mention in either the documentary or the article further on Tama Iti and John Tamahere. And I mean, Tama Iti has a, and that's where I felt that things were missing. He's got a well-documented decades and decades
history. Talked about the business links that China's using to further its ambitions or its aspirations. They don't talk about the cultural infiltration that they've had for some time in New Zealand. Trevor Loudon, of course, is the maven for all information about that and can link many of our prominent politicians on the left with various Maoist organisations. And of course, you know, we've seen the Māori Party and the Labour Māori MPs busily, as I like to say, putting the Mao into Māori in an accelerated way over the past few years. And it's fascinating the shift that we saw from John Tamahere. And, you know, Winston's kind of our knight in shining armour in this. He is an accomplished statesman, and he's actually playing the Chinese at their game in terms of he's allowing them to save face. He's not giving too much away. He's speaking in a sufficiently roundabout way to not embarrass the Chinese while still making his point. But he did stand up in Parliament and quote John Tamahere from a speech he made in Parliament in 2005. This is from an ex-post by Winston Peters. He said the irony and hypocrisy are palpable. What John Tamahere said back then was, the rise of the Māori Party is unfortunate and frustrating. It is not Māori. Māori is a generic term. The group of people who have supported the rise of the Māori Party are actually tribal fundamentalists. I call them ethno-nationalists, right? The problem with the Māori Party is it is led by a bunch of people who have done extraordinarily well out of protest activism so they can tell their children why they should vote against things, why they should march against things, and why they should dislike others. It is quite clear the Māori Party is built around New Age educationalists. Okay, and by that you can read neo-Marxists. Reconstructionalists in terms of history. So, you know, we can trace that back to the Maoist Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution and the academics and the elite around the Treaty of Waitangi checkbooks. There is no case and no space in this country for separatists. Somehow, in the intervening years, which included at least one trip to China with, according to Trevor Loudon, former Maoist Christopher Hipkins, or at least someone who hobnobbed with them, he's changed his tune 180 degrees, and now it's hard not to think that the Te Pāti Māori represents a fifth column, gradually white-anting the New Zealand national identity. And, you know, if you want to take the fight out of a people, you just repeatedly tell them, you're not legitimately here, your ancestors are colonizers, your ancestors are settlers, you know, you don't belong here, you've got no say here. It takes the fight out of Kiwis that is so necessary to resist the kind of infiltration we're seeing from the CCP.
And this is where the long game comes in and how brilliant they are, because what Stuff Circuit covered was the economic angle that they took with those who were predisposed politically in that direction. So the mayors in what is predominantly a rural centre-right-wing agrarian areas. Yeah, Southland, they've gone and done that with the National Party. They had a dinner in the documentary. They talked about a dinner that they all attended and that there was a candidate that they would have preferred, and they were gently sort of coaxing Bridget, I think it was Simon Bridges, who was the leader of the National Party at the time, and Jamie Lee Ross, who were in attendance, to try and coax a certain candidate that they would prefer to see that was Chinese, without out and out saying about it. So they sort of work the business and corporate angle. Meanwhile, culturally, they work the cultural angle, because that you can't work on class, let's work on culture. So they're fighting this at multiple fronts to obtain influence and control over certain groups to actually help, you know, lead a pathway. And then I think to myself, well, why were they doing that? Why do they want that level of control or want to know so much about what's going on in little old New Zealand?
Mm.
Because I think, what is it that we've got to offer? And then I suddenly thought, well, actually, I think what we've got to offer isn't what we're growing on top of the ground, but it's what we've got underneath it.
Yeah, that's one aspect of it. In an excellent podcast, Simon O'Connor did, it was called the On Point Podcast with Simon O'Connor, had a fascinating interview with Joshua Kurlansik, where he detailed how New Zealand and Australia had been basically a testing ground for the CCP to infiltrate the wider West. You know, we were kind of the first up. We've historically had a close relationship with China, and, you know, I can talk about how that fits into something like the I Ching. You know, there's certainly precedent for it, and if we go over that, it does outline how we might manage it. But they want access to the Pacific. They want to pinch off Taiwan. New Zealand's got very strong relationships throughout the Pacific. So we're a key to making that move. It's a wider part of, again, I'm trying not to use emotionally loaded language, but, you know, the hegemonic aspirations. And, you know, we've had the US being a single power. Now, there's plenty of evil things about the US, but they're not harvesting organs from political prisoners and then chucking their bodies away evil. They're not a million people in concentration camps. The concerning thing for me is that we've had leaders who have been pragmatic to the extent that, you know, they might raise those as concerns in whatever way they do. And it's right that they do it behind closed doors for the reasons I said before. You know, we've got to appreciate the cultural need that Asians have for saving face. It's a big thing there that it's in a way that it's not here.
One of the things the documentary, it started out concentrating on the influence peddling, and then it sort of transitioned from that to the supposed targeting by the CCP of former Chinese citizens and dissidents living in New Zealand in a way that you would never get away with if they had targeted New Zealanders, for example. So there was a car accident that happened, I think it was in Tokoroa, and it was a number of protesters that were going down to Wellington to present a petition, and they were killed, and there was only one survivor. And, you know, was that an accident or not? And another dissident who protests every day outside the Chinese embassy, and she went in with her car, and there was some act of sabotage in her car. So, you know, they were asking the questions, do you believe that this is the influence of the CCP in New Zealand? They believe themselves that they have been targeted, and this is actually happening. But it just shows you the long game that they have, that they're targeting those own citizens and not other Kiwis. And you're right. I mean, Winston Peters, he has seen this sort of influence over decades. He's been one of the few that's been around to see it. And remember, he was heavily criticised for what, the $1 billion up to the Pacific. And I can't even remember which coalition it was now that he was in. I think it was around, was it about 05, 06, somewhere in there. And he was heavily criticised for that. But he did it because he could see, as foreign minister, that there was a lot of initiative that was going on in the Pacific, and money was being spent, and it was being spent by the Chinese. They were building roads and buildings in Samoa. They were building government building brand new wharfs in Tonga. They were building the new courthouse in the Cook Islands. They've spent billions and billions of dollars in the Pacific developing those relationships. Why?
Well, yeah, they're ambitious. You know, and Winston Peters spent a fair bit of time as foreign minister in Washington. He's very comfortable there. You could understand he doubtless made relationships with people in the US. There was that speech he gave talking about how the world had changed and how it's not the benign strategic environment that Helen Clark naively postulated back in, when it was it, 2005. Winston Peters probably is more on top of it than Nanaia Mahuta was.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Talking about, well, you fellas have got the dragons and we've got the Taniwhas, so, you know. I have a real interest in to what extent is this racial conflict that has been just stirred up so deliberately in New Zealand over the last 6 years? And you could also say, to what extent does it benefit someone who would like New Zealand as a client state if the population of law-abiding people are largely disarmed?
That is a question.
Before the election, as I've said before, Christopher Luxon was asked, you know, some of this infrastructure you'd like to do, would you see us using the Belt and Road Initiative for that? And he said, well, if the numbers add up, yes. We don't want to be naive about the extent to which our politicians are meeting with Chinese officials and they're saying, hey, look, you've got $40 billion worth of trade with us. You know, you can say, by all means, express your concerns about the million Uyghurs in concentration camps, the social credit systems we've got and some of the human rights abuses, but don't go too far. You'll want those social credit systems soon when you introduce your own central digital bank currencies.
Mm. I do worry about what, and this is what you said, is the long game, what interests do they genuinely have in New Zealand? Is it the minerals under the ground? Is it our strategic location to the great last untapped resource on
the
planet?
What they say, because Premier Lee Kuang, I hope I'm saying that right, Premier, put a one-page ad in Monday's New Zealand Herald on June 17th. Premier Lee Kuang's message to New Zealand, you know, in it he outlined the reasons why New Zealand and China should be friends. We both respect Mother Nature. We both embrace cultural diversity. You know, again, I guess the thing that really annoys me the most about it is the difference between Chinese TikTok and TikTok in the West.
That was exactly, I literally just wrote down here TikTok.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing that's, you know, that's kind of one of those don't listen to what they say, watch what they do things. And I think there's anything that we should feel entitled to speak out against, it is the corruption of our youth. In the same way as America should be outraged at the amount of fentanyl that's coming across their borders from China and killing so many people.
Well, it's also about that also extreme left-wing craziness, that clown world. I mean, yeah. What did they? They've got that. Was it Baijiao? That the word for essentially a woke white nut job.
Yes, I'm like, oh, you want to let all these Muslims into your country, you fools.
Yeah, I think it suits them. As you said, it's a long game. I think it suits them just fine, because in a way, how much influence do they have in terms of degradation of a culture? Well, probably not as much as we might think, because we're doing quite a good job of stuffing it up ourselves. But they certainly are sitting there watching and looking for opportunities. And that's, I guess, where these initiatives come in, where the relationships come in, because they know that many of these countries need them more than they need us, you know?
And there was never any mention of the CCP's very strong influence on the WHO in any of this. And I mean, that's another, as I said, it's coming at us from so many angles. We're like that group of blind men, the Buddha described, trying to figure out what an elephant is. So, you know, the fire and fury, Paula Penfold got her nose into, you know, the areas where business people might be pushing New Zealand towards the CCP. She's really, as I said, she never mentioned CCP at all, that it wasn't mentioned in that article.
Well, they were talking to, like, they went to that Chinese COVID lockdown protest to talk to people who were critical of what was going on in China and the China. And they didn't say a lot, but they were sort of inferring that, you know, these are people that are concerned about the CCP. These are people who are some of the victims. And yet, And yet, just months later, they make a documentary that is absolutely scathing of anybody who questioned anything around the pandemic and what happened. And knowing that they started making this documentary prior to Fire and Fury and finished it after Fire and Fury was smack bang in the middle of it, the cognitive dissonance that they had bouncing between the two, because they were asking a whole bunch of the right sort of questions around the influence peddling, and yet they weren't asking those sort of probing questions when they were doing Fire and Fury. I mean, that was almost like this crazy, weird old disinformation project type propaganda piece. You know, it was very, for me, very odd.
It was weirdly one-dimensional, wasn't it?
So to round things out for people, if they haven't seen The Long Game, and actually I do recommend it. It's not a difficult thing to watch. I actually found it quite interesting, to be honest with you. And so don't sort of be put off by the fact that they are the Fire and Fury people. Just watch it, see what you think.
Yeah. And go research the first and second act yourself.
Exactly. And have a look at, see if you can see any holes. I mean, what are some of the things, you did lots of research around this and lots of different avenues. Where did you find things that were quite interesting?
I did a search of podcasts, and I listened to Crossroads, an Epoch Times podcast with Joshua Phillip, and he spoke a lot about what's going on within China, spoke of the paranoia that's emerging in the CCP as Xi Jinping increasingly models himself on Mao and grows increasingly autocratic, basically wants to be the only person in charge. So the hide your strength thing is gone. The black cat, white cat, it doesn't matter as long as it catches mice, which means, hey, if we behave like communists, if we behave like capitalists, it doesn't matter as long as we spread our influence. That was very interesting. There was a lot about what was going on in China in terms of mobilizing militias with companies, getting school children involved and mobilizing them militarily, which is reminiscent of, I think it was called the Little Red Guard. And he's really starting to take a lot of cues from what Mao did in the Cultural Revolution. That should, I mean, it's obviously worrying Chinese, but it worries me when I see so many echoes here with our friend Ferris, you know, basically saying, this is the Kohanga Reo generation, you know, so we're drawing the lines, kind of like the end of history. You know, a lot of what those guys say is very, as I said, it's putting the Mao into Māori. Yeah, overall, there's a feeling that there's an upping of the ante. You know, things are moving quickly. There is that thing with history. Everyone is surprised at how long it lasts and how quickly it changes. Mm. Christopher Luxon was stupid to have gotten caught up saying, you know, we haven't punished China yet. You know, that was a trap for a young player. Winston wouldn't have fallen into that one. And of course, we've got the media constantly trying to trap him into saying something that offends the Chinese. It's, you know, I mean, I hope as we're discussing this, we're not saying anything that's unnecessary while not flinching away from speaking the truth. And, you know, the other really interesting thing that I came across, because I did have a look at a few papers that I'd maybe glanced through for Media Matters, and I'd missed a few things. You know, I'd missed, for a start, that Premier Li letter to the people of New Zealand, but I'd also missed a joint column by Helen Clark and Don Brash. And I mean, this is absolutely peak. I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. You've got former National Party leader Don Brash, Reserve Bank governor, who chairs the New Zealand subsidiary of the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. So he's got a dog in the fight. We've got Helen Clark, former Prime Minister, who headed the UN Development Program and is really pushing the WHO agenda. And they're both twisting their hair into pigtails and about New Zealand, the importance that New Zealand doesn't take sides. The government also resurrected an old story about how China had tried to hack the parliamentary computer system, even though this story was 3 years old and the attempt had been thwarted. David Fisher of the Herald, good old David Fisher, he often pops up in the stuff too, doesn't he? And then, yeah, sort of that hatred that Helen Clark had for America, like any good, I won't say communist, but, you know, very left-wing person from the 60s. Add into that mix aggressive attempts by the US to slow China's economic growth through draconian tariffs on Chinese-made electric cars, solar panels and batteries, and prohibitions on the export to China of certain high-tech products made in the US or with US technology, which China often steals, just saying. And the situation has the potential to get seriously out of hand. In this situation, every country needs to make decisions which are in its own best interests. I mean, it wasn't necessarily attributed to Helen Clark, that, but Winston wrote a very good reply to that. Did you read that?
No, I missed it.
AUKUS in New Zealand, where were Don Brash and Helen Clark during Labor's engagement on AUKUS? So he wrote three key facts. The New Zealand government has been actively exploring the option of joining Pillar 2 of AUKUS for more than a year. Foreign Minister Winston Peters says the government is a long way from this point of being able to make such a decision. And the third fact, AUKUS is a strategic defence partnership between Australia, the UK and the US. New Zealand is not involved due to its nuclear-free policy. Pillar 2 relates to sharing advanced technology such as artificial intelligence and quantum computing. So the key thing in this is he basically pays out on them. These two individuals, decades after retiring from frontline politics and relinquishing the ability to access classified information about the strategic foreign policy challenges facing our country, have formed an unlikely alliance of their own. They stand united in their opposition to the idea that the coalition government should continue a process begun under Labor of carefully weighing up what potential benefits might exist from any partnership with AUKUS, Australia, United Kingdom and the United States, over the development of advanced technologies in AUKUS Pillar 2. And so he's saying that he simply needs the leader of the opposition, Chris Hipkins, permission to basically release documents, and we cannot see a reason why he would withhold it. It is Labor in opposition that is seemingly walking away from the bipartisan positions on AUKUS Pillar 2, which is both convenient and irresponsible. We urge them to hold their nerve. And that's the long and short of it. He's basically calling them out for cowardice, which it kind of is. Why? Because it would be utterly irresponsible for the coalition government, indeed any government, to not consider whether collaborating with like-minded partners on advances in technology is in our national interest. So that's what I was saying before about Winston being a master of this diplomatic speak. You have to read between the lines a little bit on that, but what he's saying is we're getting pressured to make the traditional alliances of New Zealand, US and Australia weaker by not participating in it. And if we go to the I Ching, the aspect of the I Ching which teaches us the way to manage such a relationship is called Lu, which means treading or conduct. It says the fact that the strong treads on the weak is not mentioned in the Book of Changes because it is taken for granted. For the weak to take a stand against the strong is not dangerous here because it happens in good humor and without presumption, so that the strong man is not irritated but takes it all in good part. That's how we need to be insistent but good humored, you know, so the angry protests aren't the one. The situation is really difficult. That which is strongest and that which is weakest are close together. The weak follows behind the strong and worries it. The strong, however, acquiesces and does not hurt the weak because the contact is in good humor and harmless. And if you listen to Premier Lee Kuan's summarizing of New Zealand, he said, "We both stand for world peace. This largely stems from our similar national characters. New Zealanders like to call themselves Kiwis. The term, as I have learned, refers to a bird and a fruit, and both are sweet and lovable. This nickname is now widely known in the world and has become a symbol of the kind, genuine, and friendly people of New Zealand." We are poised to create change, but we must go about it the right way. And I think the biggest concern that we have is one we talk about every single week in Media Matters, is this vacuum of national character that we have, this vacuum of spoken about shared values, the zipper consensus about what we really stand for is being stripped from us by people who often personality disordered malignant narcissists who want power and are probably being used by bad faith actors to weaken the country to make it easier for it to be a client state.
Well, there you go. So if anyone wants to check those out, The Long Game is on Stuff Circuit. You'll find that on their website. So just go and pop that into Google. The article was called How China Targeted Our Mayors. That was in the Sunday Star Times, June 16th. So I'm assuming that will be on the Stuff website. And yeah, as Marty said, there was that great Simon O'Connor podcast. So have a look, see what you think. Do your own digging and come up with your own thoughts on this. It's been our thoughts. So thanks, Marty, for having a little chew fact with me over this morning. I just felt that we needed to give it a bit more time than what we have on Media Matters.
Yeah, well, I hope that hit the right balance between concern and optimism. I think, you know, we can continue to trade with China, and I think we can be a voice of reason in the world, but we shouldn't be naive about what it is that we're up against.
Absolutely. We're going to let you get back to Paul now on the Paul Brennan breakfast. But remember, Marty and I will be back here on Wednesday with Media Matters, usually around midday-ish on Counterculture. So we will see you guys on Wednesday. Thanks, Marty.
See you then.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.